This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 104 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
Hi, David. How are we doing?
I'm suffering from a little aeronautical withdrawal. It's always tough being home when half the planet is out at Oshkosh, Wisconsin, watching aircraft. And this year, including UAVs. So I'm a bit bummed by all the Facebook postings and sitting at my computer desk at work watching everybody else watch the air show out there. But I'll get over it because we've got a really good show tonight with a really neat guest, huh?
Yes, we do. We have joining us Eileen Shibley. She's the founder and CEO of Monarch Incorporated. Now, Monarch designs, engineers, and manufactures unmanned commercial aerial systems for the agriculture, energy, and land survey industries. Before founding Monarch, Eileen had a 30-year career with the U.S. Department of Defense, where she was a strong advocate for unmanned systems in the Navy. Now, Eileen incorporated Monarch in 2014, and her team began providing the precision agriculture, wind turbine, and utility industries with small UAS for the purposes of high-tech aerial mapping. So it's our great pleasure to welcome Eileen Shibley to the UAV Digest podcast. Eileen, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, Eileen, let's get the tough stuff out of the way. What kind of drones did you play with when you worked for the Department of Defense, or are you going to tell us that that was all classified?
Oh, my gosh. I had the wonderful opportunity of actually running the Unmanned Systems Division for a few years, and we worked at everything from the really small little handheld devices all the way up to the Predator and everything in between. And it was actually during my watch that we integrated the Predator with the F-18s in the same pattern. So I got to see a lot, and it was really fun. It's where my passion for this area comes from.
Had you done any flying before, or was this sort of your introduction to flight?
No, that was kind of my introduction, and boy, it was an interesting one because there were all sorts of things happening all kind of at the same time, and a lot of interest in where this was all going to go. And so I kind of got the whole deal all at once, but only started flying this year, actually.
Well, maybe we can circle back to some of the military experience you've had, but let's talk about Monarch. So tell us, why did you start Monarch? What was the motivation for starting Monarch? And what are some of the products and services that Monarch offers?
You know, it's really kind of interesting when someone says to me, why did you start this? The honest answer is it was an accident.
Sometimes it is.
Truly what happened was that there were a group of us who were, I was leading the California effort to see California recognized as one of the six FAA designated test sites for safe integration of UAVs into the national airspace. And when California didn't succeed in that bid, the few of us that were left said, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? We've built this quadcopter. And what we were doing with the quadcopter was we were taking it all over the place and doing briefings for the purpose of getting people used to thinking about these things as other than defense-related and other than just hobbyist craft. In other words, suggesting some applications in the commercial sector. Well, we ended up going to a class offered by a sensor manufacturer down in the LA area, and there were 42 or 3 attendees in the class. It was an internationally attended class. And we did a demo of our system, which we hadn't even named Monarch yet. We just called it the Quad. And one of the people there wanted to buy it. And so one of the guys called me and said, can I sell this to him? And I said, no, you may not, but tell him that we'll build him one. And so we built one in the garage, and that was our first one. And never having done any business kinds of things like this, I thought, it's probably some paperwork we have to do. I probably need to get a license or something. I don't know, maybe you need to do like a purchase order or something. I didn't know what any of that meant, but we got it figured out within about a day and made that sale. And a month later, sold another one. And a month later, the first customer was very pleased with the results they were getting. They had an agricultural application. They wanted us to build another one. And at that point, we decided that we were out of the garage and probably needed to, maybe we were onto something and probably needed to think about incorporating. And so we did at that time. Hmm. So that is literally how we got started.
Now, maybe you could describe the quadcopter for us a little bit. What were its features and what kind of components did you use? And where did you get the expertise to pull it all together?
Our quadcopter is, the aircraft is similar to a lot of the ones that you will see, carbon fiber airframe and Avroto motors, all the high-end speed controllers, all the standard kind of stuff. And as far as the brains of it go, we've experimented with several different autopilots and are actually in the process of building our own. We've designed it and just have to print it now. But there was a gentleman who I met actually at a trade show, and he had been in business for himself very successfully in the Hollywood arena for many years. His name is Jeff Parisi, and he had decided to get out of the special effects business. He sold his company, did well enough that he could play for a while, and what he wanted to do was build quadcopters. And so he actually built our very first one. And we very significantly modified it. But some of the features that ours possesses that we think are interesting, we design ours. We're a system engineering house. That's what we bring to the table. And we design these to a customer's requirements. We are very interested in safety. That's paramount. But next to that is ease of use, because we don't want people to feel like they have to be mechanical engineers to be able to operate these things. And also, ours is a more beefed up platform because we want it to last the test of time. We want a farmer or other kind of operator to see this as just a tool that he can throw in the back of his truck and use it over and over and over. So we care a lot about repeatability and reliability. But we also designed a sensor housing that literally allows us to put our high value items, in other words, the sensors or cameras or whatever kind of device you are integrating, into a cocoon housing that if you do get a bit of wind or do have a slightly bumpy landing or something, you're not going to damage those high-end sensors. We have about a 25-minute life on our battery. We can fly autonomously or we can fly FPV. I think another thing that's very different about our system, and again, we do this born of understanding requirements from the end user. All of our cocoon sensor housings and our new design gimbaled housing hold at least two, if not up to four sensors. Hmm. So we can have an RGB, or some people call it an EO, a visible type sensor. We can have a near IR. We can have a thermal imaging camera. We can have a DVR, all going at the same time.
That's interesting. Now, the primary market that you're kind of starting with, is that precision agriculture?
That's where we started, and we've got a brand new 333 as of the 22nd of May, and it is specifically for precision agriculture. But in addition to that, we're very keenly interested in the energy sector, everything from wind turbine inspections to solar farm inspections to pipe inspections for the oil and gas companies to stack inspections. And then we also find that there's a tremendous and a growing interest in just the standard civil engineering surveying community. That you can use these as a validation tool as well as to augment your surveying, standard surveying practices.
Eileen, maybe tell us a little bit about how the process went for getting your 333 exemption. Was that a smooth, fast process for you at Monarch?
define smooth or fast.
I know. It's got a loaded question.
Actually, it wasn't bad. We struggled because we are a new start. you know, we have all the standard problems of any new start, and mostly that translates to cash flow. And so, you know, we know a lot of folks, you know, are paying a lot of money, and we looked into who we could get to write our 333, because obviously we wanted it to go through the first time. But frankly, I couldn't afford that, and so we wrote our own, and you know, said a Hail Mary and a couple glory bees and put it in the system. And it wasn't that long. I'm thinking it was less than 3 months before we were notified that it had been accepted.
Oh, that's not really too bad.
And you weren't rejected. You were accepted on the first pass.
That's correct.
Well, then I think you're well ahead of the game. I did see someone on the Facebook page about legal UAV saying that he actually got rejected the first time, but he thought it was a really good experience. And the notes that he got from the FAA, he was able to put through a second one. So it sounds like the FAA is getting on their game.
We've actually found that experience to not be bad. And their web portal, we've easily, you know, put stuff in through that. And they've been responsive when we've asked questions as well.
Eileen, can we just dove back? What was your experience? I'm curious what the experience was like when you were working for the California UAS test site. What challenges, if you had to do it over again, what do you think you might have done? And what's your overall opinion of the whole process? You know, now that we've got six up, it seems like a lot of them aren't really doing much. So I was just curious what your whole feelings, and since you went through that process, what that was like.
Yeah, that's certainly, I'd probably get myself in trouble in about 8 seconds here, but they're, you know, obviously it's a big national process, and so it's fraught with all kinds of interesting political considerations as well as technical. And I guess we felt like we had probably the best technical proposal going in. The FAA did a wonderful, forget what you call it when you put in for a government contract and you are not selected. They do a exit interview kind of thing. They call it something else and I can't say it, but they did that with us and they walked us. They spent over 2 hours with us, walked us all the way through our proposal. And basically, you know, we ended up asking them, geez, were we seventh out of six or what? Because we didn't have any negative comments. Ours were all positive. And we know that we're in a beautiful place to fly because we are very remote. We're in the middle of nowhere. And actually in our business, in Monarch, we're taking full advantage of that. We do have 350 days of sunshine every year where we live, and so we fly every single day. And we're pretty unfettered by commercial traffic, and so we're luckier than most. We're also in a kind of a Navy town, and so there's a general acceptance of drones. There's no fear of it. And of course, you know, we understand that the rest of the world isn't always that lucky to live in a town that embraces this kind of thing. So, and I'm sort of skirting your question, but I think that I think they'll get there. If we look at North Dakota, certainly they're a model. They've done some absolutely amazing things. I think Alaska, even though they're, you know, they're doing some great things too. So I think we'll get there.
Eileen, I wanted to ask you about others who are starting up businesses, maybe not as formal necessarily as the company that you've put together, but there are a lot of people out there who maybe have a bit of an entrepreneurial bent, see that with a $1,000 or $1,200 investment in a drone from Amazon or something like that, they can go out there and start offering services to real estate agents and others. And then we have the much smaller number, I guess, of organizations like yours, and we know of many others, who are trying to start a business and do it within the constraints that are placed on us by the FAA at this point. Do you butt heads with some of the rogue operators, as it were? And, you know, how do we address that kind of problem?
Yeah, I guess I'd put the kind of the rogue element in two parts. And we have a lot of folks right around here who are really, really good RC operators. who just kind of want to do this on the side and make a little bit of money at it, doing either, you know, real estate or marketing photos or whatever, whatever. And we applaud them and we champion them and we'll work with them all day, every day, because I think that's what, it's what our economy is built on. And I'm kind of old fashioned in that sense. I truly believe that we ought to let the market kind of, you know, do its thing where this is concerned. And so we're going to stay close to them. We're going to work with them. We're going to help them. They're going to help us. That's the way that works. The ones that we have angst with are those who are behaving irresponsibly. And we all know who they are, you know. And those folks, we will do anything we can to educate them about the stuff that they're doing that's going to give us all in, you know, a bad name or get us all in trouble. But some of that's inevitable. Some of it's just plain going to happen. You know, anytime there's a new technology, especially one that is disruptive to processes as this one is, we're going to have to go through some pain and agony as a society to get to a point where we can figure out what the right checks are and the right balances. And I guess I feel hopeful about the legislative environment. We stay involved in that. We've got some active people here in California at the national level. On the House side, there's an unmanned caucus. And I think they're trying to do a lot of right things. And, you know, you've also got the other side of that, the people always going to be resistant to change. And especially with something that can be a little bit scary to people, like this technology can be. So we're very sensitive to that. But at the same time, we're not letting much slow us down. We're moving out and we're moving fast because we have a firm belief that the technology that we've developed and many, many others with us is going to change things for the better. And that's what we embrace. And that's what we want to be part of. We know that people are going to save money when they use these things. We know that, they're going to make lives easier. We know that we're going to find things we couldn't find before because we use this technology in its good way. And so we're just full steam ahead and moving as fast as we can. And as I said, we're not letting a whole lot slow us down.
When I look out across other industries, I see some that regulate themselves. And I see others that never kind of developed to the point where there was a power source strong enough to coalesce that self-regulation kind of a function, and they get regulated by others, by legislation or by other things. Do you have any thoughts about where this industry may end up? Do you think that it will become self-regulating to a certain extent, or do you think it's going to come from external sources?
Well, my hope is that we can do a lot of that self-regulating, because I think that if we don't come together as a group and as a community with a vested interest in the future of this and ensuring that we're all playing the part that we're supposed to play in integrating these things into the system, then what's going to happen is that we're going to get handed a bunch of laws that are going to make it more difficult for everybody that could benefit from this technology. So I think it's incumbent on us to do our part any way that we possibly can. I think a large part of that's education. And so along those lines, as a practical example of what we do, we go into the local school system every chance we get and every time they ask us. We talk about commercial applications. We talk to the kids. We do that all the way through the high school level. We work with the robotics club at the local high school. We work with just about anybody that will work with us. We have other maker environments, and we have them in our spaces sharing resources if that's practical. Like everybody seems to want a piece of our, you know, big commercial 3D printer, that kind of thing. But again, back to the question at hand, my hope is that we'll get to a point where the community will speak, you know, either through a trade organization like AVSI or something like that, so that we can be taken seriously in that realm and not find ourselves, you know, overregulated.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's the way to look at it. And even though that I may be a little personally discouraged that I don't see as much movement in that direction as I would like, on the other hand, we're really at the early stages of this industry. And so maybe it's maybe it's too much to hope that it'll come together that quickly at the beginning.
I don't see anywhere near enough either. It's a frustration for me because having been in this community for about 3 years now and as a business for a year, it seems like we could be further along. But then I will freely admit that I learned a very long time ago that patience is a virtue that I must struggle with.
Let's return to sort of the daily operation at Monarch. We can use the example of precision agriculture or anything else really, but how is that working? Are farmers coming to you? Are you going to them? Do you have to convince them of the value that these things can provide, or do they already have an idea? Where does all that stand right now?
You know, one of the things that's been the biggest lesson for me, and I think probably for most of our crew here at Monarch, I grew up in a little farming community in South Dakota, and I can tell you right now that in the last year since we've been in business, I am completely stunned at the level of sophistication that farmers, at the level of technology that they use right now. They ask us questions that stump us sometimes, honestly and truly. And sometimes they come to us, sometimes we go to them. Mostly it is, there's no convincing about the technology. They're already there. Our struggle, I think, and this is just for ag, our struggle is with the data, because the data is what's going to make a difference to that farmer. If we can take pictures all day long out in his field and we can use our software and stitch those pictures together and create mosaics for him. But if we can't give him something in that informs a decision, then it becomes a harder choice for him to say he wants the latest gadget. And that's where we're at right now. Now, we've made some great headway just in the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 months in that regard. And I think that we're at a point right now where the data piece of this is catching up. I know that there are all kinds of people out there who advertise that, you know, they can give you everything under the sun, practically, you know, predict yield before they even leave the farm. But I'm telling you right now, from our perspective, I will just say we're not there. Where we are, however, is we now possess an ability, many, many, many thanks to 2 brilliant summer interns that we had here at Monarch from the University of Northern Iowa. Both GIS grads, both working on their master's degrees in GIS technologies, and they set up our data department, and they just did a masterful job. So we're at a point right now where within 24 hours, less than that, we can do a quick look report and then finish processing the data, and within the next day, we have a full report that will inform.
So, Eileen, you're actually going out and doing the flying for the farmers, or is your goal to provide the hardware and software for the farmers and have them do it, or is it a combination of both?
Our business model shows a combination, and all my examples have to do with us going out and farming because we just got the 333 exemption, and so we couldn't really provide the service until then. But we see ourselves doing both, and some farmers want the autonomy of being able to go out any time of the day they want without having to schedule it with anybody, and so they want to buy one. There are other farmers who don't want to monkey around with another piece of technology, and they just want to say, can you come every 12 or 14 days and do this field or that area or whatever, and we're happy to do both.
Yeah, when you were talking about the sophistication of the farmers, that confirms what my experience has been that, these are business people.
Oh, absolutely.
They are very cost conscious. They have slim margins, and they want to make smart decisions that impact their business. And so they need to look at what's it going to cost me? What are the returns going to be? You know, what's the payback?
Exactly. And also, how's it going to affect my process? You know, if they've got a big farm, you know, however many thousand acres, and they've got a certain way that they do things, and you introduce something like this, what does that mean for them in other terms too? So they're really very, way more sophisticated than I remember growing up anyway.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned the interns. The team at Monarch is pretty good sized. I mean, this isn't just, you know, you and one or two other people doing all of this.
Oh gosh, no, we have a stellar team. I have absolutely no idea how we got lucky enough to have the right collection of people all together at the same time. It's pretty eye-watering for me. And And we're kind of a family here too. We've had some rough times. We've had some really good times. And everybody's kind of in this for the long haul, and we know that we're going to have more bumps in the road as we struggle and as we learn. We appreciate that we have a lot to learn, but we also have covered a lot of ground.
So overall, and for those listening who have thoughts about creating some kind of a commercial operation around unmanned aircraft, what is your advice to those people who are kind of struggling with how do I get started?
Just jump in and do it. That's it. Because some of the things I struggled with, I just look in the rearview mirror and I go, golly, I learned a lot, but, I don't even know who I would have asked. Just jump in and figure out what needs to go next. And it'll either come together in the way that you want it to, or you'll become frustrated and it won't. But, that may sound very simple, and I don't mean to be trite about it at all, because it's been an extremely difficult year. I am no stranger to hard work, and I promise you no one on this team is, but we've worked really, really hard.
Yeah, and that's characteristic of startups, or at least startups that get beyond just the conceptual stage.
Yeah, and again, this team that we've got put together is just absolutely amazing. We've got some brilliant people that all focused in the same direction, and I think that's what it takes. It's never ever just one person that's good at this or one person that's good at that. It takes everybody with the same objective and the same kind of vision. And our vision is, as I said, to make things better through the use of these things.
Well, David, what do you think?
I think they're going to be very successful. Eileen, your depth of knowledge is helpful, I think, to going forward, and you have a set of experiences that a lot of people don't have, and I'm really thankful that you took the time to come on the show. Where do you see yourself? Here's the old question: where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Oh, we're going to be a $1 billion company selling these things internationally, of course, no doubt in my mind, absolutely none. By the way, one of the other things that we're very, very excited about right now is the opportunity that our California State Park system has presented us with. We now have 3 COAs through them. And here in a couple weeks, we'll be doing our first COA. So wish us luck. It'll be a really, really fun experience mapping our state parks.
That's awesome. Exciting. Yeah, very exciting.
And maybe you'll share that when you get it done and come back to us?
We'd love to do that.
Great. Eileen, tell our listeners where they can find Monarch.
Find us at monarchmakers.com. That's Monarch like the butterfly, M-O-N-A-R-C-H, makers, plural, monarchmakers.com.
Was there anything sort of subtle or about the name Monarch?
Yeah, we kind of wanted something that, my criteria for the team came up with the name, I didn't. And I said my first criteria is that it must be one word only. Only one word. And I want it to be something peaceful that doesn't imply defense, nothing against defense. Obviously, I spent 30 years of my life there, and I'm very grateful for that. But I want it to be something that didn't connote defense, and that also had to do with flying, and that had to do with kind of a peaceful contribution to flying. And that's where Monarch came from our team.
That's great. Well, David, we had some news items teed up here, but we only have a few minutes left. Do you want to zip through some of these or hold them off till next time?
Why don't we hold them off to next time? I did get a feedback today, actually. It came into my inbox this evening. So why don't we touch on Jessrin's question. This is one of those questions, and maybe Eileen can jump in and help him with this. Started off with, I really enjoy listening to your podcast every week on the UAV Digest. I'm looking into starting a company for UAV mapping, but I first want to get proficient flying a drone. I'm looking at starting with a drone that I can fly inside to get the basics and move up to something like a Phantom, then eventually a drone that's more geared towards mapping purposes. I'm looking for some advice or recommendations. What would you recommend for small UAVs to fly indoors? I'm familiar with the current regulations and also the U.S. 333 exemption process. Thanks for your help. So, Eileen, you got any suggestions?
Absolutely. He should come to the Monarch training class. We actually do. I'm all in seriousness. We offer a training class. One thing I would mention is that we're a little nervous about people using really small craft, you know, the very inexpensive craft, and then putting extremely expensive sensors on them. I worry about that a little bit. I don't know that I'd necessarily advise it, but here at Monarch, we offer a 3-day training class that ends in a person actually writing their own mission plan and flying their own system, their own flight by the end of the 3-day training class. We offer those in a couple different locations here in Ridgecrest and in Bakersfield, California.
Oh, well, Max, they're on the other side of the country again.
Well, maybe we'll have to make a road trip coming up or something. but seriously, we do run across a number of organizations offering training, introductory training, beginner training. And we get feedback from our listeners from time to time that suggests that sort of the quality of these offerings is somewhat uneven.
I've spent a lot of money and didn't get much out of it.
We've definitely heard that from people who have come to our class. We've only offered our class a few times, but one of the things that we do, and ours is offered by our pilot, who is a certified flight instructor as well. And one of the things that we have created is this 3-day syllabus, which is pretty sporty, and he follows that very carefully. At the end of the class, we ask everyone to please fill out a at the end of a class?
A survey.
A survey. Tell us how we did. And we're darn near 4-0. So we've got some happy folks that have taken our classes. And again, I think it's because we're technical. We're going to tell you about the airspace. We're going to tell you about the FAA environment that we are all flying in these days. We're going to talk about, you know, gimbaled environments and sensors and autopilots and why would you pair this with this and why would you do this with that? We're going to teach them how to do mission planner software. We're going to actually fly. It's a different kind of experience than some we've heard of.
Hmm. Well, I like where our listener Jezrin is going with his email in that he doesn't have drone piloting skills at this point and sees himself, I guess, being the pilot in some kind of a business that he's looking to start. And I like the idea of, you know, if that's the case, yeah, you've got to learn how to be the pilot. And starting small makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
This is the part that Max and I are still failing at, is the learning to fly part.
It's not for everybody.
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it?
But that's good. And I think that, you know, there are a number of small quadcopters, generally under $100 or up to about $100, that are lightweight, not too expensive, so that when you crash them or lose them in the, you know, in the lake or, you know, whatever, that it's, it's not a huge problem. You certainly don't want to start out with a $1,000 or $3,000 or $10,000 multi-rotor that's, you know, fully capable of carrying a full, you know, full sensor suite and all that. You don't want to learn how to fly on one of those. But there's a lot of small ones out there that are great for learning, I think.
There are. We use them in our class because it is, you want to get the feel of it before you take control of something that you don't even want to think about what it costs. You want to get that feel first. So, yeah, totally agree.
Well, I know there's a publication or two, some ebooks, for example, that talk about, you know, your first quadcopter. And maybe we'll try to dig out some of those and put those in the show notes for those who are kind of looking for some specific recommendations or who just want to understand what's the thought process that they should go through. Because there are some differences between, the smaller quads, and there's some different considerations in selecting your first one.
I'd encourage him to jump in there, though. I think there's just room for everybody.
All right, David. I think that'll about do it for this episode of the UAV Digest. We want to thank all of you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed hearing from Eileen Shibley in Monarch and can kind of draw some lessons from that, particularly if you're interested in moving into a commercial kind of an operation with UAVs. You can find us at theuavdigest.com. Show notes you can find at theuavdigest.com/104. And then, of course, David, we're all over the social media.
Yeah, we've got now over 4,000 Twitter followers on UAV Digest. Our Facebook group is growing, and that's facebook.com/UAVDigest. And of course, we want to hear from you. And if you have an answer for Jesrin or a suggestion, you can do what he did. Write us at feedback@theuavdigest.com. Or if you want to touch base with either Max or I specifically, it's max@theuavdigest.com and david@theuavdigest.com. And if you want to support the show, we have multiple ways you can do it. You can leave a review on iTunes. That helps everybody find us. I'd like to say that we're getting close to 50 reviews there, but we could use a lot more. Or if you stream us from Stitcher, leave us a review there. And if you'd like to buy some swag or, you know, advertise the UAV Digest with a T-shirt or something, we have a cafe press shop. And, of course, we have our patron account, who we always thank our patrons for helping us fund this so we can bring the guests like Eileen to you. And that you can find the cafe press and our patron from our homepage at theuavdigest.com. So I guess with all of that, I'd like to say thank you for listening. And this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Until next week, folks.